so let's set the context. The context of this is you have the safe and secure side of which is not a long you have a written for the proletariat, which is a long book. Three long books. You know, three long books on a total of, you know, safer, maybe less than 2,000 lines. Right? So there's obviously a lot of creativity.
And so we should have writes and end out.
And also, you understand, this is somebody, you know, he has so much code in his head. And he's just desperately trying to write it down right before it gets lost. And that's the image I get. Right? He has so much code in his head. And there's no way he's ever going to write it. No one's going to listen to it. And he's there's no way he can write it all down before he dies. So he's just desperately writing. It's a wild feeling. And he's right. There's tons of Torah in his head that no one will ever know if he doesn't write it down. And it's a desperate feeling. Now, the conceit of the book is that Rasadi Gaon, like everyone else, for whatever mysterious reason, thinks the number 613 is important. Yuvar Nakos says number 1 is important. Number 613 used to be important.
No, they say 1 isn't. You can't go by 1. 1 is too little.
We get down to 1.
But then they reject it. From what I remember.
And they go back to 3 or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Ibn Ezra is not the only one claims there is no 13. Shetan Shastan too.
No, the Ramban says that.
Yeah.
The Masorah.
Yeah.
The Ramban. Like a dual lama. Yeah. But in practice,
it's really serious. Even the Ramban.
No, the Ramban is 2 days. The Ramban in 1 day is not true.
In practice, does anybody know of a list of mitzvot longer than 613?
No.
No.
The Ramban assumes that there probably is, in 1 day, assumes there probably is one.
Yeah.
But he also has to go down the line.
The Ramban is 2 days. He says either it's a Masorah, he said, or it was Rav Shmuley's post facto kenching.
Yeah. But it became a convention.
Well, didn't
it
become
a convention? Everyone writes a mitzvah book, writes 613. But the problem is that to get to 613, requires a selection principle. It is very hard to come up with a selection principle that, you know, if you come up with too rigorous a selection principle, then you can't get to 613, because we can just create a list of 7 or 8 categories, everything 7, right? Then we just say, oh, everything else fits under. Right? Or if you come up with too tight, with too broad a selection criteria, you end up with more than 1,000. So it's hard to come up with selection criteria. And it's not entirely clear how successful any of the people who articulated selection criteria were in actually following it. Right? For instance, often you don't necessarily think of the alternative. Often you're just working off someone else's list and you just tinker. But if you weren't aware of 6 other lists, then there are all sorts of options you never thought of. There is also a problem made by one of the few people, perhaps, who actually read all the lists and memorized them. And therefore, he has all the options. He has categorized them into schools, right? He has all his criteria. His goal is to try and develop the selection criteria of Rasadi Gaon, and then justify all his choices in light of those selection criteria. Now, that often involves a selection criteria per se only work at abstractions aren't enough, because it may be that the nature of particular hypothetical commandments changes depending on your specific halakhic position. Right? So actually what you're doing is a combination of selection criteria and halakhic, right, and halakhic decision making. Right? Because your selection criteria has to get you down to 613, but actually it will often leave you with the possibility of more than 613, but it may be that, let's say, you're left with, let's say you got from 1,000 to 700, and then you can eliminate the last 87 by saying, well, the selection criteria combined with passing like this sheet against that one gets me down to 613. Okay, that's the intellectual superstructure of the book. In this particular essay, the issue is that there are mitzvah lists that list separately commandments against cursing others and commandments against cursing yourself. So the issue is, right, what Rasadi Gaon does not. So he has to figure out why is there not a separate commandment or cursing yourself as opposed to cursing others, especially since the Gemara seems to cite different sukkim. Right, for cursing yourself and cursing others. So those should be two different mitzvahs.
Wait, and he counts it as only as one.
It's not only lists one.
Okay.
Now, whether that one includes cursing yourself or not is open. They only list one love of cursing people who are not a nasi. Or a shofet. Okay? The Gemara says that the Azhara for Akhelim is both the Kalil Kinrish, and the Azhara for cursing yourself is the Shmornash Shafam, the Shamalukal Shmornash Shafam. Okay, there's the opening section which doesn't deal with, sets up the selection criteria about overlapping assays and overlapping loves, and the question is whether he shall marry the love or an assay. That's all intended for our purposes. But you should be aware, that's the overarching goal of the essay. Now we can tip it off. Okay, so anybody know how it ends? How does he answer that question? Nobody got to the end. Okay, so we'll kill the ending. The ending is that the reason Rav Sanya Gaon doesn't quote a separate law for Mikalei Latzmo, even though the Gemara quotes Ein Amora, who says that cursing yourself is Asur L'Dibur Ekol, is that even though there is an Amora who holds that cursing yourself is Dibur Ekol, in fact, the question of whether cursing yourself is Asur is connected to the question of whether wounding yourself is Asur.
Then how can you say it's Dibur Ekol?
Not my focus. So that person doesn't understand that it's connected, right? Since those two positions are connected, therefore, Rav Sanya Gaon holds that it is permitted to be mekalel yourself because he holds, like the Rama, that it is mutter to wound yourself. Okay, that's the dramatic answer.
So the Rasag holds like a position that comes 500.
This is all of them.
That he holds like the Yadamah.
He holds like the position that we all set later is the Yadamah, that later is held by the Yadamah.
Okay.
He's not fasting like the Yadamah. He's fasting a dime.
The Yadamah didn't make up the position. He just said that's how we should fasting in the Mahomet Tanoi.
That comes to the same thing. Now, along the way, what is more interesting is that Frillo is going to argue that the Rambam agrees with this too.
Oh yeah, that he leaves out the Hakini Pisani.
Yeah, right. That the Riff and the Rush agree with this position. And we'll end up that the Riff, the Rush, and the Rambam at the Adrama against the Rimigash.
Wait,
the Rambam
says,
Asur
Lachbol
Bein Ba'Asmo Bein
Ba'Acher.
But only for
Lashay Adayim,
and not for...
Only Derech Nitzayon.
Only
Derech Nitzayon, which in general doesn't really mean very much.
Well, how can you have
Derech Nitzayon? We'll have to get there.
And he doesn't think much of Nitzayon either. It's Nitzayon or it's Bizayon. It doesn't really matter. I can just throw them together.
This is the superstructure, right? The whole purpose of it is to explain Rav Sanya Gaon. But in order to explain Rav Sanya Gaon, we have to show that, right? Since we don't know anything about Rav Sanya Gaon, and we're not so into presenting Rav Sanya Gaon as holding positions that nobody ever held thereafter, right? We want people at least 500 years later to have held the same thing, right? Because someone should have followed it too. So basically, he channels Rav Sanya Gaon into what he believes are pre-existing as. And it turns out that the Maskana is a Dhamma Shah Lakov Vasmo for everybody, but the Rimigash, including the Ram and the Rit and the Rush. For all we know, he thinks that the Shulchan holds that way too. Since all the Shulchan Aruch is doing is quoting.
That's
what I'm just like drama.
No, I know that. And
the Rush.
And
everybody, actually.
You can say
it,
the
Shulchan
Aruch. The Rambam
is in itself. In a parallel universe.
Alright. I don't know what you said. So it's just, I think it's a useful corrective to the assumption that everyone has, that we need to prosecute a Kena Dhamma Shah school last mode, because, do you want to prosecute against the Ram and the Rift and the Rush? That's fine with me. Okay, so
Rumigashi is standing there. He's like, guys, he's like, don't look at us. We're on that side.
Okay.
Like, how did this happen?
Oh, that Rumigashi.
Now, look, you have to recognize that this is how halakha was decided, at least by Ashkenazim, for hundreds of years. The official prologue is not doing anything new. He's not doing anything unusual methodologically. He's thinking exactly the way he was taught, which is exactly the way his father was taught, his father's father was taught. This is the way he thought, right? He's not.
When was
the Rehudot prologue is early 20th century.
Oh,
so this is.
You read Rambams and say that they mean the opposite?
That's
sort of
logical.
You thought, right? You line up the positions, and you right, you assume that the Salvation's metaphor is the giant clockwork theory of the Talmud, or, you know, where everything Talmud is this giant Rube Goldberg machine that everything has to tie together. You right? You push a lever here, and that releases a parachute just to knock down the dominoes. Right? It releases the train, right? Which pushes the gate, which releases the balls.
That's not like to deal with. Saying the Rambam is the opposite of what he
says. No, you can't say the Rambam is the opposite of what he says. You have to show the Rambam at least with their own
clearly, obviously meant, without a doubt.
I will suspend judgment until I hear the argument.
Okay, so you got right. You have to. I know when Rabbi Shulman at YU gave shir here, my second summer in Boston, and you know the YU call on the second in Boston, and no one could understand the word of you. And truth is, we gave Kabur in YU, and no one understood what he was saying either, because it was a methodology every bit as alien as Brisk was when it first, you know, to some degree, came out saying. Nobody had ever done this. Nobody had the skills to keep the balls in your head. Right? So, you know, and I recognize that.
He does, like, serious football?
Yeah. And I recognize after 3 years in YU, I couldn't do it anymore. You know, I remembered that I had been able to do it in high school. But I couldn't do it anymore, you know, and I thought it was a great summer because I got there, and then we had a chavrita in Shev Schmeitzer the next year, which helped me get some of the skills back. And I keep trying not to forget totally what it's like. This is not actually, the editor of the Rebbe Fischer Prologue is fun, and he knows a great deal, but there's nothing methodologically unusual or far-fetched about what he's doing. If you read Shuvah's Noted Yehuda, right, a good Shuvah's Noted Yehuda is much, 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 much wilder than this, and will say things that are from a perspective which looks at the text independently as opposed to as part of the system, much less plausible. Okay, but it's an issue in the system is whether, right, if you, as same as it is in Torah, right, if you assume that there is a concept of pshat outside the system, then you evaluate the result by whether it coheres with what you might possibly have thought this text meant before you put it in the mix. But if you assume that in the same way that Torah Shebichtav is a unified document, and therefore Torah Shebichtav contains contradictions, and there has to be a resolution to that contradiction, even if that means that right that a text is limited to a wild okimta. Right? That's what we think about Torah Shebichtav, right? There are contradictions. There's no way to resolve the contradictions except by claiming they're talking about different things, even though a text seems to say explicitly A, but other texts say explicitly B. Right? And the only way to get to that perspective is by assuming that those texts don't really have a meaning outside that context. And this is the meaning they have in the system. So he assumes the same thing about rabbinic texts. That every rabbinic text is only meaningful in the light of every other rabbinic text.
In the Talmud or everything?
Everything. But every Rishon knows every text.
Right.
So any Rishon is writing on the assumption that you know perfectly well every other text. And the notion of a pshat, right, you know, like a pre-canonical pshat, right, is not so much more meaningful than the question of, you know, whether there were snippets of Shir HaShirim that existed as Zemer before they made it pre-canonical. Who cares? Right, this is what it means as part of the system. Yeah.
You can't assume that they knew texts that came after that.
No.
But
all the texts that happened are just possible interpretations of the period. It doesn't assume they knew it. This is the way you think. Right? And the simple test for this methodology, right, is, like any methodology, whether it in fact is a meaningful methodology, is if you train people to think this way, do they generate the same results? And the answer is yes. Right? You can put 20 mythopoulim, give them the same data, and you will generate the same results. In the same way that if you put 20 briskers, you know, I used to have the joke, you put 70, I said it about good guys. If you put 70 of them in separate rooms, lock the door, ask them about a pair of shots, it comes out identical, it's not a miracle. Unlike the target treatment, because you're trying to take a party of the way, the answers become obvious.
This is all about creativity, and that can.
Creative people are creative, and uncreative people are not creative. The creativity is not the same as creativity functions. T.S. Eliot has a wonderful essay recognizing all of the cultivation of the individual talent. She tells you creativity only exists against the background of expectations. And I said, personally, I always quote this from early Seth Farber. When I was in NYU planning to go up to Maimonides to teach my first year, he warned me correctly that the real problem I would have teaching is that I self-conceived as a Maimonides. So when I taught, the fun of it was, here I am saying something creative, but the students didn't know what it was I was supposed to say, so they couldn't know what appreciating it as creative. Because they didn't know that wasn't what you were supposed to say, and so it was utterly lost at the teaching methodology. Creativity only works against an expectation. Every methodology has a certain element of predictability. The less creative people produce identical work, the more creative people change around the margins. Really creative people develop new methodologies. And it's kind of paradigm shifters in Kuhn's terminology. A methodology is meaningless and arbitrary if you cannot train somebody to come up with the same results. But if you can train people who have not seen the data in advance to consistently come up with the same results as for new data sets, then you have a rigorous methodology. You can decide whether it corresponds to what the original intent of the authors is, and that there is no way whatsoever of checking. But you're not making it up. So often, when you come to a methodology that you're not used to, and you see a result that you couldn't have predicted, it doesn't strike you as creative, it strikes you as arbitrary. The only way to test whether it's arbitrary or not is to say, if I taught somebody else the exegetical and logical principles this was based on, would they do the same thing? And the answer, I think, pretty clearly is if you pick up 10 volumes of people who use classes with Mike Foley, you have classes you should have built at some point. You pick 10 volumes up, you pick up the volumes produced by the 22-year-old guy putting out his first collection of Kedushin. And the 50-year-old shul rabbi writing down Shurim. They will all raise the same questions and develop roughly the same answers. Just some of them are better and some of them are worse. Every once in a while, one really brilliant guy will come up with something that no one else thought of. But there's nothing unusual about what they're doing. I think it's really important to understand this is not a methodologically creative
thing. He's just very good at what he does.
He's very good at what he does, I think. Now, I'm not an expert at it. He's very good at what he does. I think you can see the same, I think, some other true people are not so good at what they do. Some books that became famous in the 20th century. He's very good, right? He knows a great deal. He knows how to manipulate it. But he doesn't do anything that would be unusual or unrecognizable to what to his peers.
He wasn't told about Reb Chaim, according to the biography.
The Gamanitziv.
So he has brisk in him. He's not, those people are not classically used
to. You have to distinguish between.
Not just
read Wikipedia with a grain of salt.
No, I said that's true. You have to remember that if you read the tradition of Chaim, they're kind of still solving problems through Hezbon. He just happens to introduce concepts into the discussion more centrally. But Reb Chaim did not do this. Reb Chaim is not giving a gushir. All right, so it's not. Reb Chaim, has a problem. He works out the Hezbon. It turns out that he thinks that often the way to resolve it is not just to line up these positions with other positions, but to come up with a conceptual hakira. But it's not.
What's a gushir? What does that mean?
Whereas a gushir, I think, or a rose lecture, you just start off with the idea and you're just trying to line people up how they fit in the spectrum of the idea. There are no problems.
Are there no problems?
In a gushir, there are no problems. All there are ideas, and which texts and which positions line up with which idea.
Yeah.
right, might have a problem once in a while to try and figure out, worthwhile saying, well, which of these two narrow, right, which of these two fine points of Akira does this Rishon? But the goal of putting it into a system and trying to come up with a Rishon as a comprehensive result to all the data, actually, Akira, you're trained to pick out the conceptual line of the Rishon without regard to how it fits in the whole thing. It's an entirely,
I've never experienced that.
Yeah, so this is a...
Is that because of Aaron was Mechadesh, this kind of subset of methodology?
I think Rav Aaron was, you know, again, this is, you know, speculation. I think Rav Aaron was Mechadesh this in many ways. I think it's also a reasonable evolution of the Driskin system. I think that in large measure, it is a function of the vast, the decision to try to integrate the vast new amount of material that we have, which simply you could not read in time. Not possible to read all the Rishonim of the Sugya and go anywhere unless you learn to read them really fast. And I think that was always the argument of Rav Zweig. Explicitly, right? When he taught us explicitly to read Rishonim like a newspaper, figure out where the headlines are. I think that there's moderations. I used to go nuts here in the summer to get people to read great thinkers who really couldn't read at all. And I think that the methodology has shifted more. There's much more focus on reading again. But I think that those are different methodological goals. So I want to start. I don't think your competition is very, very good. And it's important to recognize that when you're in the middle, you don't really. That's why I wanted to set up the superstructure. Because if you're in the middle, you might not really know what he's doing. But he has a very clear goal. And he never loses track of that goal. Right? It's a coherent, well-structured essay with one purpose in mind. Right? He knows where he's going, and he goes there. He goes there not in a straight line, but in a straight plane. And he's never off. Right? There are no tangents that he's not interested in. Right? For this purpose, and he never loses track. The ultimate goal always is to demonstrate the possibility of not having a separate ashara from the kalel asmo. There are only two ways to accomplish that, right? This is the brisker version of the shir, in a sense. Why is there no Azhar from Mekal Atzmo? You have two possibilities. Either Mekal Atzmo is included within the Mekal Acherim, and it's one category, or Mekal Atzmo is Nasser. Okay, so the essay is basically set up to try and figure out which of those two alternatives is the correct one. Okay, the first part of the essay, which we're not doing, is goes through the first possibility, trying to find ways in which you can include Mekal Atzmo and Mekal Acherim. Having disposed of that, because you can't find, right, that would be a pure selection criteria phenomenon. Right, even though Mekal Atzmo is Asur, there's a reason that you don't need to mention it, because it's included in one of the other 613, and he has five or six options as to which of the other 613 would be included under. Right, because it can be included under Mekal Acherim, it can be included under Kobel Atzmo, it can be under. Having eliminated the selection criteria possibility, he is left with saying no, but actually need to line up according to halachic position, and the halachic position he chooses that it's not a surah at all. Okay, so I think I picked it up at the paragraph beginning of Fize on page 85. Again, recognize that's why so much of this essay is around the Yad Ramah. Right? Because he knows in advance, right, that he can just do two things. All he needs is two things. Right? He needs to prove that the Yad Ramah is plausible, and really means it. And he needs to prove that the Kalel Asmo is connected to, right, to Kovel Asmo.
I didn't finish it, but I could even see on page 90 that's where he's going,
yeah,
with the Tosfot.
Right, that's all he's trying to do. Now at this point, he's already established to his own satisfaction that you can connect Kovel and Mekalel. Okay, so we're not going through the lumbus in which he establishes his satisfaction, even though the position that says Dibri HaKol, the position that says it's Dibri HaKol is not Dibri HaKol. And that happens. You don't have enough locus where one person says Dibri HaKol X, the other person says no, not Dibri HaKol.
Existence of the other person,
they can't be the correct call. No, Dibri HaKol is about the previous machloket. And Dibri HaKol just means, according to both positions, in a predefined machloket, right? It's not as bad as the Maribe Rav's claim that he has absolute consensus, despite the relevant. Okay. So the paragraph beginning, beginning of the Fusa. So here's what I understand is what happened. So, right. So having established our satisfaction that the disputes about Mikalel and Provel are connected. Right. He then says, "Oh look, we have a case in which somebody puts himself in peril." Now we know from other sugyot that putting yourself in harem counts as cursing, because the Gemara talks about the question of how it's legitimate to ever put somebody in harem, because that's a violation of Talal Harem. So if Mar Zutra put himself in harem, it follows that Mar Zutra holds that it's mutter to curse yourself. If the positions about cursing yourself and wounding yourself are lined up, it follows that Mar Zutra holds that it's mutter to wound yourself, and now we have a basis for the Adrama. It's just talking like Mar Zutra. Okay, right. That's the paragraph beginning of the Fusa. Okay. So, right. So then what he has now is a new raya for the Adrama. So that raises the question: oh, gee, but what about the Beis Yosef? Beis Yosef didn't bring this raya. Okay. So we have a discussion about what the Beis Yosef actually thought. So the Beis Yosef says that, right, so he goes through basically the same conversation we have here with the Beis Yosef, right, where it says, well, if you have the girsa we have in the Beis Yosef, then that the mashmalay did the shum dufta, lesle, althe gershane leil. So we have three problems with that. One is, where did this rule come from? Two is, it's not like Pasuk Nagalos are a copy here anyway, it's Pasuk Nagalos Rabbi Akiva. And three, he's got lots of other places where Mother Akapar shows up and it doesn't seem anybody knows about this rule. Because people muskin like it. So that raises the possibility that the Knesset Hagdola actually has a different Gersa. Whether the Knesset Hagdola actually has a different Gersa, or it seems to be more likely the Knesset Hagdola changed the Gersa. I can't tell you. And it's Mishum Dukta. But he says, well, guess what? If it's Mishum Dukta, that tells us absolutely nothing. We don't know which Dukta it is. Right, so I'm very happy with the girsa of Mishum Dukta. In case you think I'm wrong, right, this is the whole cheshbon in the head, is he thinks his whole goal is to prove that Mikalel and Kabbalah are connected. What he said now is, if Mikalel and Kabbalah are connected, then there is a raya for the Yad Ramah. But the problem is, the Beis Yosef presents an alternate source for the Yad Ramah. Right? Why doesn't the Beis Yosef put this one? Yeah.
Why is it, if there's a connection between Mikalel and
Kabbalah,
there's a proof for the...
Because Mar Zutra cursed himself. So the Mar Zutra must hold his mutter to curse yourself. If it's mutter to curse yourself, it must be mutter to wound yourself.
Why didn't Mar Zutra curse himself?
He put himself in harem.
Was that in the Gemara?
That's different. No, it's a different Gemara. It's not Gemara.
Oh, okay.
Right? That's his whole thing. Quote is Mar Zutra Chassid into this. Okay, so now he's proud. So he has to. So the failure of the Beis Yosef to quote this Raya, right, if the Beis Yosef were right that the Adrama came from something else, there would be an issue. So he has to show that Beis Yosef, in fact, does not accurately cite the source of the Adrama, and so he is actually. Right, if the Adrama had a source other than the Kalel, then he's wrong. Somebody should, right, Beis Yosef should have quoted this. But since the, right, well, so he wants to prove that the Beis Yosef has no source of the Adrama, and therefore he is within his rights to offer a new explanation of the Adrama. What he says is that if you have the girsa, the less, right, the mashmalei mishum, the dimashmalei mishum, the mashmalei dimashum, that's ridiculous. The Beis Yosef's position is just wrong. I can prove it in many other ways. That can't be the source of the Adrama. And if you have the girsa mishum dukta, the Beis Yosef tells you nothing. So the field is clear. I am entirely within my rights to offer a wholly new source for the Adrama. And don't tell me you must be wrong about connecting Mikalel and Kabbalah, because if that were really the source of the Adrama, somebody else would have said so, because nobody else has found the source of the Adrama. Where do you get there? Okay. he says that the Knesset Agdola says Yad Ramah is simply postulating like the Breita in Shavuos against the Stam Mishnah. And the Breita says it's Mutter, it's Shavuot Haralat Matar Spal. But there again he says, what kind of Pusik postulates like a Breita against the Stam Mishnah? Okay. So part of the issue is if you think it's true. Well, no, I think it's not a compelling basis. Not a compelling basis. He doesn't think that Knesset Agdola is terribly compelling. Okay, now it gets fancy. Okay, because the Adama himself, and now we are on page 86.
Bottom of 86 or 87.
Yeah, okay, right, so we're in the second column. Around the third of the way down, in the middle of the paragraph, the first word of the line is Shum. There's Anam Be'emet, Verbiya Haramazal, Gufei Tamo. Right, the Ramah himself, already explained his rationale. Nivrei Haramah Elohim Tebiyah. So he has a very explicit proof. So the question is the Adramaz, is the Adramaz evidence sufficient? So what's his first problem with the Adramaz, right?
If I understood correctly, it's that the Chist is only talking about in a case where it's Batashchit of Guf. No. It's only talking about a case of Baal Tashchit of... There's a Gemara in Shabbos.
Good.
That says that Baal Tashchit the Gufo Adif. And therefore that happens about what Chist is saying. Yeah.
Not quite precise enough. Yes, sorry.
The Gemara in Shabbos, it shows that he's the Lishitato for Gemara in Shabbos, where he's also saying that, you know, the Baal Tashchit of the money is adding over the Baal Tashchit of his goof. We don't pass him like him. In Shabbos, it's explicit. They don't pass him like him.
Absolutely.
Right.
Good. So the Gemara in Shabbos, in which Rav Chisda seems to rule exactly the course of here, is that you don't have to spend money to avoid Baal Tashchit of the goof. Maybe I'm allowed to spend money to avoid Baal Tashchit of the goof. But the Gemara says, blessed Rav Chisda. So the stump of the Gemara Paskins against Rav Chisda, so he should not, the Yad Ramah should not be allowed to paskin like Rav Chisda against the Talmud Gemara. Okay, yes, David.
So, even if we accept that we can paskin like Rav Chisda against the other opinion in the Gemara and Shabbos, it still proves nothing because it doesn't show that there's no Kabbalah of Asma, it just shows that it's Mutter from Malcolm Hefsin.
That's where I thought he was going.
No. The point is, the Adramah needs a raya.
Right.
So
this is not a raya.
Because Baal Tashchit...
This is Baal Tashchit Demamo, and Adif mi Baal Tashchit Deguf. But in the absence of Baal Tashchit Demamo, there is still an Isser of Baal Tashchit Deguf.
Good, so now we have to go back to the conversation we had. He is reacting to Tosfos. He knows that Tosfos thinks that the only machlokes for the Rashi Lechpol and Rashi Lechpol is about the Zohar.
Right, it's
so this is the Zohar. So if you can, right, so it's exactly on point. Okay, right. He knows everything we did. He knows, right? Truth is, you know, I could do it because I knew it from him. That's why, you know, I just cheated, right? By presenting a lot of him, right, when we did the sugis straight. Yes, sir.
So if
This is more of a methodological question based on what you were discussing earlier. We know now that his methodology is not going to take him to the office, original intent.
How do you know that?
Because he says to the Iron. Because the Iron Man says he passes like a Vesta. And then he says you can't pass him like this.
Well, no. He may end up restoring, right? What it means, why it is that the Iron Man passed him.
I mean, remember, he's trying to engineer Irsadia's position. So he can wind up saying, Rav Sadia, Paskin's like the Ad Ramah, Belav Bitameh.
Yeah, he can do that also. Or he may just end up saying that, right, that in order to understand this right, you have to take six other positions. And as a result of six other positions,
I mean,
he also
has to prove that the Ad Ramah isn't stupid. Like, he has to prove that the Ad Ramah, obviously Ad Ramah knew the Sumari Shabbos too, so he has to show you now how
right. This
Raya works, even despite the Sumari Shabbos.
Absolutely.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so his first stage is when he has this problem that how can you paskin like Rav? How could the Ad Ramah claim that he paskins like Rav Fista here when the Gemara and Shabbos explicitly rejects Rav Fista? So there's a very simple Deus Ex Machina solution to that, which is what?
Cross
out the Gersa. Right? The Duke Sofrim. The Duke Sofrim mentioned that there is a Gersa which doesn't reject Rav Fista there. So we're home free. Now, you should be aware that all the halachic statements in the Gemara, is Mekabala from Professor Danzig, the halachic statements, Hilchasa, Les Hilchasa, all those are late, and they shift by geographic area, which would say that as opposed to people passing like Gemara, the Gemara simply records the Regan Halacha, right in the area.
Not everyone thinks they're 100% late.
Like all of the land, I could die. Baby's over.
My Kabbalah from Reverend Linzer is 80% of them are late.
Okay, good. He has a more accurate goal than I do. But it's not implausible to see to believe that if somebody seems to be tasking against the Hilchasa or less Hilchasa, it's because they didn't have it, because in fact often the Hilchasa got put into the Gemara because someone tasking that way, as opposed to people tasking because of the Gemara.
How late is late?
They're still moving in the
later.
Oh, we're good. Wow, that's pretty late. Well, by the Bahag's time, they're fine.
But they're different places, right? Mm-hmm. People's Girsa, it's not so common for people to shift the current, I think. People shift the existing halakha because of the Hilchasa. They're more likely to just say, I have another Girsa, it doesn't have that. So this is not an important thing. All right, but it doesn't work. Like, why doesn't this work?
Because we have another Gemara that we got earlier that has three other Amorai who take the other position. So.
No, don't do that. I'm not after that one. Niri.
Niri.
The Mei. Yeah, but I didn't understand the Mei.
Because the Niri does have that Gersa. Right, the Niri does have the Gersa in Shabbos. I need Paschim like Rav Fista here. Right, so the presumption that he's been functioning on so far is that you have to choose. If you paskin against Rav Chista and Shabbos, you paskin you have to paskin against Rav Chista here, because Rav Chista and Shabbos and Rav Chista here are connected. Right. So his problem was, we certainly paskin against Rav Chista and Shabbos. So how can we paskin like Rav Chista here? And the answer is that we don't paskin against Rav Shabbos. Oh, but the Uri does. The Uri paskins like both of them. So his assumption, there's a contradiction between them as well.
Because the Meiri Paskins like
Rav
Chista
here,
and
like Rav Chista here.
Meiri Paskins like Rav Chista with Chovei Ratzon.
He quotes the story of Rav Chista walking through the thorn bushes.
Can we put the Meiri on the list?